Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with your hosts from 970 ESPN and Steelers Nation Radio, David Todd, and from SteelersDepot.com, Dave Bryan. Just a couple of Daves chilling, talking Steelers. Now, here's Dave and Dave.
Welcome to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave. He's Dave Bryan of SteelersDepot.com, the place to get your latest and greatest Steelers information. And I'm David Todd of ESPN Pittsburgh and the Steelers Radio Network. It's Season 6, Episode 72, and my goodness, Dave, one of the craziest, most dramatic games I've ever seen. The Steelers defeat the Cincinnati Bengals 18-16 at rain-soaked Paul Brown Stadium in a wild-card game that was unbelievable, but not perfect. It was a game marred by injuries, serious injuries, personal fouls, massively big officiating calls. But at the end of the day, the Steelers did what they needed. And fortunately, the Bengals did what the Steelers needed too. And they're on to Denver.
It wasn't perfect, but it was perfect.
I like it.
And hey, we got a lot to get to today in our podcast. I want to make sure we save enough room for the Pat and Dave on the back segment as well.
Yeah, right. Why not? Dave, why don't we start with, let's get the injury stuff out of the way, because the Steelers suffered four injuries, all of which could be impactful in the game, but two obviously to head and shoulders above the others. Ben Roethlisberger suffered a whatever you want to call it. We can call it a sprain. We can call it a dislocation. But I know that Melanie put an article up on the site, Steelers Depot, that went up just about at 11 o'clock today, a separation of his shoulder. The degree is what's important. The Steelers aren't going to answer this question for us. Mike's not going to tell us tomorrow. The expectation, look, Ben's going to be limited. He's not going to practice hardly at all this week, I would expect. But I think you and I both think, Dave, that he will try to play in Denver.
Yeah, I can't come up with a scenario other than, I mean, just the arm falling off. But even then, you would think there's no way he's not going to start this game. And Melanie did a great job of kind of recapping the injury of what we know is out there right now. And Mike Vick fortunately posted a picture on his Twitter page Sunday of Ben sitting there in, I guess, the meeting room with his feet up on the desk watching tape, and he didn't have a sling on that right arm, nothing that I could see on that right arm or shoulder. So I would kind of take that as a good sign as well, too. So you would think, we kind of said heading into this game, maybe it was kind of unfortunate that they had to play on Saturday because of D'Angelo Williams, but now because they're going to play Denver in the divisional round on Sunday, maybe that extra day will be kind of key in here. And I'm with you. First day of practice on Wednesday. If Ben doesn't practice, I think he'll be limited at best. Friday obviously will be the key in that. But I mean, let's face it. This is Ben Roethlisberger. As much as we would like to get him some work in practice, probably not going to get a lot. And it wouldn't be a bad idea to probably get Landry Jones a little work with that first team as well, should something happen in the game against the Broncos that Landry needs to make an appearance.
Absolutely. And even though we both think that Ben probably gets to start here, let's be realistic about it. If Ben proves that he can't throw the ball down the field more than 10 yards, there may be a point where they just have to go to Landry Jones. I mean, I don't want to make the perfect analogy to what the Broncos did this year, but Peyton Manning just couldn't get it done physically, so they went to Brock Osweiler. So getting Landry Jones the snaps on Wednesday and Thursday would be beneficial all around, because clearly, I think Ben will need the rest, and I think your point of an extra day certainly makes a difference here. And, we're talking about a 4 o'clock start in Denver, so even a little extra time there if you're counting hours on this type of thing. The second one is the Antonio Brown hit. And look, we've heard Adam Jones say that he thought Antonio Brown was faking. He reiterated that today on the Dan Patrick Show. I don't have any idea whether Antonio Brown is faking or not faking, but I'll tell you, you're not going to see too many hits that look worse than that. Fortunately, it wasn't a full-on blow from perfect. It was more of a glancing blow. But the whiplash on the neck looked bad. The way Antonio Brown's arms kind of went out and as sometimes we see guys who go unconscious. They get stiff for a second. Looked like maybe that happened. He didn't really cushion his own fall, which, you know, if you're conscious, you tend to be able to do some of that. So I'm not really buying into anything Adam Jones says. But the good news is that after the game and, you know, from the little bit we've heard, is Antonio Brown appears to be doing okay. He told everybody he'll be fine. You know, he obviously flew home with the team. That was was no issue there. So I think that Antonio Brown will be good to go on Sunday.
Yeah, I do as well. Jerry Dulac posted an update, I think, late Saturday, early Sunday morning, maybe, saying, look, you know, he's already looks fine and is on track to play against the Broncos. And it sounds like, thanks to Ray from the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette, sounds like Robert Golden with a shoulder will be good to go against the Broncos.
Well, that's Golden saying he's good to go, right? I mean, he's got a shoulder sprain in a sling.
Right, right. But he says, he, you know, that's just him. I mean, obviously we're not in the locker room. But he played, I don't think he missed many snaps in that game anyway, despite the shoulder injury.
The good thing is he's not throwing the football. So you can wrap that baby up and you can do a lot of things that, you know, obviously Ben doesn't have to do if the injuries are remotely similar. So
And let's remember, he's a backup safety, although he does play, you know, almost every special teams position out there as well, too. I think he logged something like over 20 special team snaps in that game against the Bengals. So I will be surprised if he can't go. I think the most questionable one of the four at this point is probably Will Johnson with a hamstring injury.
And I'll tell you, Dave, he's got no chance. If he's got a grade 2 hamstring strain, there's absolutely no chance he'll be able to go. And, in fact, if the Steelers were to win, I would be somewhat surprised if he could go the next week. Look, he got hurt in the first quarter. They ruled him out immediately. Look, I've had this injury. This is a 2 to 3 week type of injury. I'll put it at less than 10%. I'll be shocked.
Yeah, we'll see. And if and kind of playing off of that, if and should he be unable to go, the Steelers obviously already were down one fullback and losing Roosevelt Nix a few weeks ago. Losing Johnson, you know, certainly is a blow, but they've been dressing three tight ends. And let's say we haven't even gotten to D'Angelo Williams. I don't know how much we'll be able to talk about his potential status for Sunday against the Broncos. But should D'Angelo be able to suit up and go, well, it gives you a perfect opportunity to also dress Jordan Todman,
right,
instead of Will Johnson. Should Will Johnson be able be unable to go?
And I'll just bet you I'll bank on it. I'll say that's exactly what happens.
And some people will say, well, you know, why would you want to go ahead and dress Jordan Todman if you get D'Angelo Williams back? Well, I think you saw. And look, this is the first of many pats on the backs here for me. But, you know, look, I've been a big Jordan Todman fan ever since he was signed. That initial post that I put up on him after that happened, you know, I spent about 2.5 hours in film studying and cutting GIFs up for that as well, too. He's more than capable. I think you saw that with some of his jump cuts, some of those runs that he had against the Bengals. Now my only question is with Jordan Todman, and take this either back to injuries or whichever way you want to go with it after this, David, is why not give that guy a chance to return a few kickoffs? No disrespect to Marcus Wheaton, who's done an admirable job. But, I mean, what do you have to lose by not putting Todman back there, who has experience doing this, and especially if you're going to have to dress him anyway, why not give him a look or two in Denver? But more than anything, if you do dress Todman in place of Will Johnson, it would be, you know, a role that probably would be extremely, extremely limited, might not even see the football on offense, but would be there, give you an opportunity to make some plays on special teams.
Well, and also if Williams were to get re-injured or anybody gets hurt, you got a very capable guy. As far as the Denver thing, they could put you or me back there. The kid kicking off for Denver is going to be kicking them in the stands, so it doesn't really matter who's back there. The Steelers aren't going to be returning any kicks in Denver. And with Gus,
very, very true as well.
And with Gostkowski in New England, Steelers might not see a kickoff return until the Super Bowl, if they're fortunate enough to get there. So that's one thing that they probably won't see next week, but I like the idea. I'd put a lot of money down Will Johnson can't go, and I think Todman's the obvious guy to take his roster spot. Dave, all right, let's get to the nonsense in this game. And there was nonsense on the both sides of this. Look, I know a lot of people have told us they are really excited to hear this podcast, and we're excited to do it. We were going to do it yesterday, but we didn't want to kind of get off schedule for the people who were here on Monday. But let me just say this. It's not all wine and roses, okay? This is a game where there was, you know, things going on with both teams. And Dave and I probably aren't going to agree on all this stuff either. And you don't have to agree with either of us or whatever your opinions are. We're just going to give you our thoughts on it. You know, there are a lot of calls. It's an emotional thing. For the crowd, it was emotional. Obviously, for the guys in the field, it was incredibly emotional. And, you know, Dave and I do this for a living, and a lot of people are passionate about the Steelers and have thoughts about it. So we just give you our views. If yours are different, great. Feel free to write us, you know, at theterriblepodcast.com and share your views. A lot of people have already. But, Dave, let's start with the stuff that happened, and let's kind of take it sequentially and with Mike Munchak. And my take on the Mike Munchak thing was I had no problem with the official calling the foul because in real time, if the official's standing there and he doesn't have a perfect look at the play and he sees what looks like Mike Munchak pushing the defender, who was it, Nelson? I can't remember. Pushing the defender toward the Steelers bench, kind of swinging him a little bit. And that's what he sees. Then he throws the flag. Now, do I think Munchak's intent was to do that? Probably not. Did he get his wrist caught up in his hair? Possibly. Were there some other things going on? Did he think he was going after Todman? I don't know. I don't know the answer to any of those things. But I really wasn't bent out of shape about the flag.
Let me say this. Go back and watch that thing and wait for the replay to see how late the official throws the flag. If you're going to throw that, why wouldn't you throw that immediately after kind of it looks like Munchak kind of wants to do a do-si-do with,
with him.
Now,
well,
it does
the one thing I will say is it's on the Steelers sideline, so it wasn't like there was encouragement, you know, where sometimes officials get influenced by the sideline. Nobody on the Steelers side's yelling at him to throw the flag.
Right, and that's what I'm alluding to. You have to kind of look at what happened kind of post that. And it's really hard to tell. Did Munchak, when he, you know, after the two exchange, well, look, I mean, Nelson got the first really visible two-handed push in, right?
Yeah, and that's one of those things where a player kind of running off the field at speed in the play of the game and guys standing on the sideline. I always think those guys are much greater risk than they apparently think they are. You know, maybe he's just trying to stop himself. But, yeah, it definitely looked like he pushed him a little bit.
Okay, but, I mean, I'm even talking about after he's already been swung by Munchak, watch him come back and kind of two-handed shove Munchak. And the flag was thrown after that, and it's hard to see if Munchak maybe got in one final push when those two kind of went face-to-face. Here's my take on it. I don't have an issue with Munchak being flagged. But I really think that should have been a flag both ways and offsetting.
Okay.
I think that's the best because, I mean, there's no doubt that Nelson gets a shove in as well, too, after Munchak kind of drags him by. And go back and look at how late that flag was thrown. If it should have been on Munchak, you know, right for the initial kind of, you know, grabbing him by the arm and swinging him by, that flag should have came out much earlier, in my opinion.
Fair enough. So, and the dumbest thing on Twitter for the weekend came from Mike Greenberg of ESPN, who said that of all the things that happened in the game, he thought that Mike Munchak should be fined the heaviest for his actions. And that fortunately, from what I saw of Mike and Mike this morning, he kind of backed away from that and didn't kind of proceed with that line of reasoning. But I saw that yesterday, and I just kind of laughed and pointed it out on Twitter as somebody who had clearly lost their mind in terms of evaluating the significance of it. You don't want coaches involved with players and having them interact. And, of course, we're going to get into this in terms of what happened later. But that set the stage. That's, okay, point number one. Point number two, Dave, and, you know, I'm going to go through five of these, and if there are any I've missed, please jump in. But point number two was the personal foul on the hit. I think it was Sean Williams' hit on Marcus Wheaton. And the Steelers got the benefit of the call, and I think it was a bad call. And, you know, I've watched this a few times, and these are the calls that are really tough on officials in terms of whether a guy's defenseless and whether a guy, the defender, is leading with his helmet, and whether then the third thing, when I say leading with his helmet, like the crown of his helmet. And then the third thing is whether it's helmet-to-helmet contact. So there are all sorts of different things that in a split second an official has to figure out, and it's incredibly difficult. And in real time, I didn't think it was a penalty. When I watched it in slow motion a few times, I still don't think it was a penalty. Wheaton got three steps down. It looked like Williams bent with his shoulder, led with his shoulder, didn't make head-to-head contact or even shoulder-to-head contact. So I think the Steelers got one there, Dave.
From what I can tell, he still made contact with the head, even though it was with the shoulder, right?
Well, I didn't think that's where the initial contact was, so.
Well, I you know, look, Mike Mitchell's been penalized for less, right?
Oh, yeah, no, I'm trying to look at each play alone. I don't care about other plays and other situations. I'm trying to look at the rules, and as this play was called, I think the Steelers got a break.
All right, I think it deserved to be called. I really do. I mean, it was a vicious hit. So I think it deserved to be called. I don't think they got away with one. I'm pulling this play back up right now as you're talking. Go ahead.
Okay. The Shazier hit. I think the Steelers got away with one there as well. And if you go into the rule book, the deal here is once two players are outside the tackle box, the rule that pertains is you're not allowed to lead with the crown of the helmet. And it was a great play by Shazier, but if anybody thinks he didn't initiate contact with the top or crown of his helmet against, you know, when both players are outside the tackle box, then we'll just agree to disagree. To me, that's clearly what happened. Now, they didn't throw a flag, and from there the referees blew the play again. If you didn't throw the flag, then you shouldn't have blown the whistle, and Shazier recovers the fumble and returns it for a touchdown. Here's what I think happened. I think Shazier delivered the hit. They didn't throw the flag, but they also didn't see the ball come loose, because when I saw it in real time, I certainly didn't see the ball come loose. And we know Gio got knocked out on the play. If everything had gone the way it went, it should have been a fumble, and it should have been a Steelers touchdown. So I think they blew the initial call on Shazier, and then they blew the call on blowing the whistle. Tomlin did the right thing in challenging the play, and the Steelers got the ball, so they got the benefit of that. They didn't get the benefit of the touchdown, and the Bengals didn't get the benefit of what I think was clearly leading with the crown of the helmet.
Okay, I'm looking at the I've got it stopped on the still right now of the hit on Marcus Wheaton. The shoulder is going into the helmet, of which Marcus Wheaton kind of lowered, was in the process of lowering his head. It was not helmet to helmet, however.
And the call was here, and this is important. This is an important distinction. They didn't call that hit. They called defenseless receiver.
Okay, and he is, in my opinion, sort of defenseless.
Yeah.
Okay. Let's
get to the Shazier one, because that's a monster one.
Well, to hear Mike Pereira talk, Mike Pereira called it a legal hit. Now, my question is, it is kind of similar though to Marcus Wheaton. What, you know, define two steps and define being able to defend oneself.
Well, this was, to me, the penalty is crown of the helmet. This is pretty clear to me. This is a different rule. You know, there's no doubt. It doesn't matter whether it hits him in the head or not. He delivers the blow with the crown of his helmet against an opponent, and they're outside the tackle box. So that, to me, is the rule that applies. I think, you know, for most of what I've read today, talking to other people, I did see Mike Pereira say at the time he thought it was a legal hit. I haven't seen him retract that, but I've seen virtually everybody else that I've seen comment on it say that it's, you know, their thoughts where it should have been flagged. I just think you look at the rules, it seems to me, I mean, we agree he led with the crown of his helmet, right? That we agree on?
Yeah, yeah. And Mike Carey, for what it's worth, which isn't much, called it an unfortunate hit.
Yeah, right, in that Poznanski article, right.
Kept calling it an unfortunate hit. I can see where that probably should have been a flag. I mean, if I'm going to call the one on Marcus Wheaton, then I suppose you got to call one on the Shazier as well too. But look, the league needs to do something to better define this, and whatever that is, and whether or not these type of hits should be reviewable on top of it, right?
Yeah, I think so, because, you know, this is the type of thing where I don't think too many people are happy with the targeting rule in college. I understand where they have it, and it's, you're trying to teach guys and make sure you get that right. But they don't call that very well in college. This is an important thing. And look, they do review it essentially, and the way they review it is through fines and or suspensions. And we're going to see that as we get into the next play. But yeah, this
should they automatically review these type of penalties?
Well, you know, it goes into
and not cost a coach a challenge or whatnot.
I guess those are two different things, right? You can't review the penalty, but you can review the play. So they reviewed Tomlin reviewed the play. If you want to review the penalty in terms of was it helmet to helmet or not, whether the penalty should stand. I mean, I'm forgetting things right, but I know most people, you know, say, boy, if there are three of those a game and that's going to add another 2 or 3 minutes, do we really want that?
I know AR2 would be against that. He thinks the game has slowed down enough as it is, you know, with all these reviews.
Yeah.
So, you know, you're right. I think you're the way you kind of opened this segment saying that it, you know, these are tough calls or bang, bang plays, split, you know, decision type things. It's tough. And on top of it, look, I think it was sort of a gift back to the Bengals to not to rule that a touchdown.
Yeah.
You know, afterwards.
For sure.
You know, two rights don't, or how does your old saying?
Yeah, two rights in this case screwed everybody.
Yeah.
So the next one is the perfect hit on AB. And look, thank God it was a glancing blow. And I heard Michael Irvin. I've heard Marshall Faulk talk about it. I've heard James Harrison. James Harrison said, you know, he's been in the league office the way the rule's written, it's a foul. He says he doesn't think it should be because of reaction time. I will tell you something. These guys who look at these plays and say, guys don't have time to react, they're not telling the truth, or they don't really understand what their own capabilities are, because you see guys react in a split second all the time. Let me give an example. A baseball's coming at 98 miles an hour at a guy's head. It's there in less than a second. They get their head and their bodies out of the way. These guys see these things and they're reacting. When they have more than a step, that's plenty of time to do something. Now, does it mean you're going to get it right every time and they can get their head out of the way or to the side? Absolutely not. But Burfict locked up his right shoulder. He didn't extend it. He just locked it up. He ducked it, and he was going after Antonio Brown. Could he have hit him harder or hit him slightly differently that would have been worse? Probably. But was there intent, and did he try to hit him the way he hit him? You can't. I'll never believe for a second that the answer to that is no. It's absolutely yes.
I don't know. I mean, yeah, when you look at the when you compare that slow mo to the one with Wheaton, I don't see where the difference is.
Well,
I mean, he lowered his shoulder. He did. Look, he could have really. He could have buried his. He could have lit him up with his helmet.
He could have.
I
think he went for his head with his shoulder.
Okay.
Whereas I don't think Williams was going for the head.
And I would agree with you, but the hits are similar.
They are similar.
Now we get into intent, right?
Yeah, and I don't think Williams had intent. I think Perfect didn't. We'll never know the answer to either, right?
Right. I mean, I think if you look at them side by side and not know Perfect's history and all like that, which is, of course, hard to do, you would say, boy, those look similar. Now, you get into the intent thing there, and boy, you could be in a court of law for that, right? trying to get a jury and all that. I think they got the right. If you're going to say they got the right call on Burfict, then I think you have to say they got the right call on Sean Williams on the hit on Marcus Wheaton.
Yeah, to me, you know, I thought Williams was the least egregious. I thought Burfict and Shazier, for different reasons, Perfect for hitting with the head and Shazier for leading with the crown, were pretty straightforward. Okay, so we've got that. Now, let's get to the Joey Porter thing. I've got zero problem with the refs not flagging Joey Porter for being on the field. And if you look back at some of the still shots that Dave and I have tweeted out, I'm sure they're on SteelersDepot.com, there are plays earlier in the game where there are 10 or 15 assistant coaches on the field. And look, should Joey Porter be out there in the middle of things? No. I mean, I don't think anybody's saying that that's where they want Joey Porter. I'm sure Mike Tomlin doesn't want him there, if you ask him. He just shouldn't be there. Should they throw a flag for it? Probably not. They should tell him to get off the field if that's the case. Okay? Now, having said that, if you watch what happened, he gets bumped from behind. Gilberry kind of bumps him. And then Adam Jones does what he does. And you know what? The refs did exactly the right thing. They threw a foul, and it was idiotic. It was unnecessary, but hey, that's the Bengals, and they do idiotic, unnecessary things, and it cost them the game. And did Joey Porter antagonize these guys? give me a break. You don't think there was stuff going on the field the whole time on both sides, and it's Joey Porter who is the lightning rod to make this all go? I'm not buying any of that. This is on the Bengals being stupid.
And let's not forget that Wallace Gilberry kind of escalated this by coming up from behind on Joey Porter and bumping him from behind.
Yeah, so as I said, he got hit from behind, and yeah.
I mean that's blatant, and then Porter really, if you go back and watch the replay,
he's backing off.
Yeah, he's backing off, smiling, not saying anything. You know, or you don't see his mouth move. and then in comes Adam Jones, taking a charge at him. And then that happened several. Now, look, should the officials on the sideline do a better job of kind of policing who comes on and off the field in those situations and say, Joey, you need to get off the field right now? And if Joey, disregards that, we've seen that was. I mean, look, you got a player out there flat on the back, one of your best offensive player at that, besides Ben Roethlisberger. You're probably going to go out there and want to check on the guy, and then knowing Joey Porter, he wanted to go out there to have a word or two
right.
About it as well too. So should he have been flagged? I don't know. Did Adam Jones deserve the penalty after that? I'd say yes. And yeah, I mean, back-to-back 15-yard penalties was crucial in the Bengals losing that game. Because even if that perfect penalty, obviously it's going to stick for his hit on Brown. If Pac-Man doesn't get penalized
right
on the back end of that, the Steelers probably still got to run or would at least try to run one or two more offensive plays to get Chris Boswell in a little bit better field goal position. And, Lord knows what could happen at that point. The Bengals not controlling their emotions with the two players that have been mostly associated with this throughout the season, losing them the game was kind of fitting.
No doubt. And we saw the quote from Ed Werder that said an unnamed Bengals player said, we feared that at some point during the season, the emotional and undisciplined reaction of these guys would cost us a game. And obviously it did. So, Dave, let me ask you a couple things about the end of the game, and then we'll start getting into the bigger picture. One is you're right. That second penalty moves the ball. If it hadn't happened, the Steelers would have had the ball at the 32. So you're looking at a 49 or 50-yard field goal, depending on how they spot things exactly, which is on the edge of Chris Boswell's range. Certainly, it's not a gimme. And by the way, I guess nobody's going to be thinking anything's a gimme the rest of the playoffs after having watched poor Blair Walsh pull a 27-yarder and lose the game. But when Chris Boswell walked out there, Dave, it never crossed my mind that he would miss it. I just don't know why. And it felt like he was guaranteed to make it. Here's my question. Did you like Mike Tomlin's decision to not run another play, just kind of maybe run, even if it's just bend a quarterback sneak or a handoff to go kind of up the middle, just and then walk up and spike the ball so that you didn't have to kick off and have one of these crazy, stupid plays that, you never think is going to happen, but once every 10 years does.
I had no issue with him kicking the field goal right then because so many things can go wrong.
I didn't either.
So many things can go wrong. Look, you're well within his range. Send him out there and do it. I mean, who knows, with emotions boiling the way they are right then, too, who's to say another's kind of scrap doesn't happen and kind of maybe
the Steelers
maybe referee,
get penalty, right?
Yeah, maybe the referee said, maybe we'll,
make one up. Yeah. Even if.
Yeah, kind of. There's just so many things that could go wrong at that point. So why not just sit? I had no issue with it.
Let me ask you one other question, and this is a hypothetical. I was asking the question because before that play, remember, Steelers are on the Cincinnati 47 with 22 seconds left, and you got Ben who can't really apparently throw the ball, although he did throw a nice – it was high, but he threw a solid ball to Antonio Brown that set this whole thing up. Where was the yard line down to where you choose between field goal and Hail Mary? Meaning, how far out would you let Chris Boswell try to kick it if you had time? 55? 53? Versus throwing it in the end zone, which seems like, that's not likely.
Oh, 60 and in.
Yeah, would you let him go that far?
Yeah, I think, Roethlisberger wasn't going to be able to throw the ball that deep.
I think if it was a Hail Mary play, I would have put Landry Jones in.
Yeah, and I think you would obviously have to do that at that point. 60 and in, I guess would be that area. I mean, Boswell made some long field goals in college, right?
Yeah, he did. He made, I think 56 was his longest. So, and by the way, let's give him, first of all, let's give him 10 pats on the back for going 4 for 4. But how about also 4 straight touchbacks, and the last one was 4 yards deep that the Bengals brought out. But we hadn't seen that this year, all of a sudden knocking him to the back of the end zone.
Makes you wonder how much Wynn had to play with that, or how much is decisions from the coaching staff, from Danny Smith sometimes. You know, we get on kickers or special teams, in general throughout the year sometimes saying, why didn't they just kick it out of the back of the end zone there? We don't know what the conversations are on the sideline as to when they're telling them to do that and when not, when trying to not do that. So, One less opportunity to get burned, right?
Chris Boswell was fantastic, and he's been great all year. I've got a great love for Sushi. I also have a great love for Boswell. That is going to be one interesting situation in camp next year for those two guys. But boy, has Boswell been great. Okay, Dave, let me just ask you. Okay, I'm trying to figure out the best way to go about attacking this. And the Steelers, let's start on the offensive side of the ball, and then we'll go to the defensive side of the ball. The Steelers' offense, I would characterize Ben's performance in this game as pedestrian until the last drive. And in the last drive, obviously, it's somewhat heroic. He did what he needed to do, but obviously, who knows with 22 seconds left if they would have won the game without the Bengals' help. But he got it done, and we know he's tough as nails, and he's been an amazing competitor, and it's nice to see him get a win. I'm sure that'll be big for his confidence. It's curious that he didn't come in the previous drive and Landry Jones throws the interception, and it looks like the season's gone, and then he does come in, and you got all those kind of questions about how that all went. But what'd you think of Ben's performance? I mean, he should have been picked off by Vincent Ray at the end of the first half. The numbers are okay. In the Cleveland game, I thought he was really good and really bad. And this game, I thought he was solid, not spectacular. I thought it was just a very middle of the road, but good enough performance by Ben.
I think you have to look at the throws he didn't. I think you have to judge the performance by the throws that he didn't make. The pass to Martavis Bryant in the end zone was a great throw, I thought. Throw over the middle to Marcus Wheaton for the play that we discussed earlier. I thought it was a great throw. The throw over the top to Toussaint late.
Great, good throw, great catch.
Yeah, I think you put it. We're only he did what he had to do on the play there.
We expect some level of that from him, right? I mean.
Right, I said this going into this game. This is going to be a dink and dunk game, and dink and dunk is really not specialty unless it's going to a running back for Ben Roethlisberger, right? I mean, he likes to let things kind of develop back there. He threw one early screen pass to Martavis Bryant over his head. But on the flip side, Darius Heyward-Bey didn't help him out on that first drive on the third down. That was a ball that Darius Heyward-Bey has to catch. Well, was it a great performance? No, but it was good enough. And being as how the interception. Look, how many times during a game do we say that ball should have been intercepted in any game?
Yeah, sure. That definitely happens 3 or 4 times. And boy, I mean, at the end of that Skins game, it felt like every Packer should have intercepted every pass. But yeah, no doubt. Look, I didn't say he played badly. I just said I thought it was an average performance by Ben, and he got it done when it mattered most. So
good enough.
Yeah, good enough.
It was good enough to win, as Mike Tomlin would say.
The two running backs were, I mean, holy cow, were they good. And Fitzgerald Toussaint, the guy comes in his career, 24 carries for 54 yards, and he had 2 carries in a playoff game for 5 yards. And he goes 17 for 58. What I loved was he ran hard. He had 2 hands on the football, protecting it the whole time. And you know what? 4 catches for 60 yards. That was the unexpected bonus there. And that catch that you referenced on that last drive, that was a really, really good catch on a 3rd and 2. Where, if you don't make that play, look, they converted a 4th down later. That the season was on the line. But Fitzgerald Toussaint, then, as you said, we've been talking about Taubman all year long. He finally gets an opportunity. He came into the game having 22 yards on 4 carries on the season. and he goes 11 for 65, including that 25-yarder when Landry Jones was in there to help them out in terms of field position. I mean, those two guys, excellent. Just, you know, just couldn't ask for more. Credit to Kevin Colbert for finding them, and credit for them for stepping up. And, you know, obviously some of that goes to the O-line as well.
Yeah, that 58 yards by Toussaint on the ground might as well have been 158 in my eyes. I mean, it only shows up as 3.4 in yards per carry on the stat sheet. Todman, look, that's what I saw on tape from this guy. Go back to even the preseason when he played for Carolina against the Steelers. Yeah, I know it was against furniture movers and all like that. But the guy has athletic ability and can a couple early on in that game, a couple of his runs were just nice cuts, nice reads, and him really doing a lot of that there. So to come out of that game with those two combining for 123 rushing yards between the two,
something like that.
Incredible. I think if you would have gave that over-under to anybody, a lot of them would have chose the under between those two combined on the ground.
Oh, man, if you give it 60, people would take an under.
Yeah, in fact, I even posted whatever their combined season total was on the site as part of the five questions. I think a lot of people chose the under on that, just didn't think they were going to get much out. Look, we said coming into this game, we felt that this duo was better than the trio that they had last year against the Baltimore Ravens, and that turned out to be true. Look, if I'm the Steelers, as immediately after the season ends, I'm going to Todman and trying to get him to sign a one-year contract for the minimum. I would like to have all four talking about Bell, D'Angelo Williams, Todman, and Toussaint all in camp next year.
Todman, there's no way I'm looking at that roster and going that I'm signing with the Steelers. I'm saying I hope this playoff,
especially not at the minimum.
Yeah, I'm saying I hope this playoff thing got me something, but I'm already behind Toussaint on the depth chart. Le'Veon Bell's going to play every play, and D'Angelo Williams just had a Pro Bowl caliber season if he had played the whole year. So I can't imagine Todman, in his own mind, says that's a good opportunity for me.
Now, granted, he's not going, regardless, wherever he signs, unless he really lights it up in this next game. It was good to get that on film, no doubt. That
paid himself some money.
That tape from Saturday night certainly didn't hurt his cause. We'll see how it turns out, and it's not a slam dunk he does come back, but it sure would be nice to have all four of those guys back in camp and go from there. Toussaint obviously will be on the roster, but that's a good problem to have right now. There's no way this team drafts a running back, in the draft this year. They don't need one.
Yeah, no chance. Okay, so the other receiver, the non-Antonio Brown receivers, not great games from Wheaton and DHB. DHB, you mentioned he dropped that in the first series. He dropped the third down on a kind of a diving catch, had his hands on it, didn't make the play, only targeted one other time, zero on the stat sheet. Wheaton made the big catch over the middle and held on, give him credit for that, but he fumbled in his only other catch on that play. A lot of people have looked at that play. Was he down by contact? Did he get his wrist down? What counts? I think the refs generally got that call right. And then the only kick return he had was late in the game after the Steelers fell behind, right before the Landry Jones interception, and he was only able to get it out to the 14. So those two guys were kind of non-factors in the game. And interestingly, you want to take the line solid but not spectacular, as I used with Ben, was Martavis Bryant was the opposite. Martavis Bryant was kind of a non-factor in the game, except for the two plays that were, decisive in the game, making, the catch we referenced earlier, and kind of the toss sweep, a play we haven't seen this year, I don't think, where he comes from the right side, and it's kind of almost student body left, like you saw with USC back in the day, where he got the edge, and 44 yards later, Steelers are in great field position to get a field goal. So he was directly responsible for 10 points. And Dave, as you said, you expected him to bounce back, and as I say, he wasn't a big part of the game plan, but he was big in terms of being impactful in the outcome.
And I also said, too, expect him to be involved with a quick pass early on in that game. And lo and behold, first pass to him, right?
Yeah.
First play there. I thought that was that was needed. I think you needed to reward him right off the bat for, you know, with the first play for the way he reacted to the comments made by Ben Roethlisberger earlier in the week on his radio show. And look, I mean, we didn't expect there to be a lot of downfield throws in this game. In fact, Ben only threw more than 15 yards five times in the game, which I think that was the number I predicted there. Only completed one to Marcus Wheaton there. But, I mean, he made plays. He, and, you know, we talk about this guy just needs to make plays in crunch time, and he did. The run aside, even if that catch, David, my goodness. Maybe that extra time. I don't see how the extra time on the jugs machine with Antonio Brown helps you out in that situation. But he was focused. That's something that I don't think he was the previous, you know, what, two or three games, you know, ahead of that. We're going to be talking about that catch for a long time as one of maybe the top 10 in Steelers history, right? I mean, there's been quite a few of them, the Swan catch in the Super Bowl, Antonio Brown pinning the football to the side of his helmet against the Ravens several years ago.
Let me ask you this. Did you have any doubts that they would overturn it?
No, they had that thing. If they did, look, well, I don't know. I guess I shouldn't say that. They took one away from Antonio Brown a couple weeks ago against the Ravens when it looked like he had it pinned to
his hip.
To his groin / hip, you know?
Yeah, so I watched it again a few more times, and I think he had control the whole way. And he went down. You know, I was wondering if he should have just made it an easy catch, and he juggled it, and that's why it went that way. But what happened was Drake Kirkpatrick really rips his right elbow down, and so Brian has no choice but to do, you know, catch the ball the way he did. He loses an arm because it was a good play by Kirkpatrick. And when I went back and I looked at it in slow motion a couple of times, that was the impressive thing, is Kirkpatrick did make the contact to get him, you know, to knock the ball away, and yet he still made it. And this is exactly what I've been talking about for 6 weeks, making the tough catches, you know, most of them around the end zone that can be game changers, where there's contact, maybe you call pass interference. You know, they're just not easy. Maybe they're not all great throws. That one was as tough as any of them, and it was, you know, got the Steelers into the next round.
You know, get the ball in the hands of your playmakers any way possible. And they did that, especially with the end around to Martavis. A nice block by Toussaint on that play as well, too. You can't. Remember several years ago us talking about Jonathan Dwyer, you know, and the prospects of him, and really us being impressed over from his early days to kind of right before, I guess, what would end up being his second to last season of how he started to play without the football in his hands and how his pass blocking improved and all like that. That's the biggest. There's a lot of running backs out of jobs right now who can run with the football. A lot of them. But it's how you play without the football in your hands that really, really makes a difference and can determine whether or not you make an NFL roster or practice squad for that matter. Toussaint and Jordan Todman have now shown. Todman has done it his whole career, in my opinion. But I think Toussaint has enough tape on him now to show us that he knows how to play without the football in his hands. And that's going to help him stick on this roster.
On that pass to Wheaton over the middle, he made a very good pickup, blitz pickup, on a I'm trying to remember who it was coming off the edge, if it was one of the defensive backs or a linebacker. But he made the play that gave Ben the time to do that, step up and make that throw. So I'm with you. Quickly on the offensive line, just general thoughts.
Good enough. I thought Alejandro Villanueva played better than Marcus Gilbert did. Marcus Gilbert, I thought, got pushed around a couple times. Look, it wasn't an awful performance by Marcus Gilbert. In fact, the only guy that had beat him for a sack so far this year, a full sack, was Carlos Dunlap, his former college teammate. So, that's a tough battle out there with Dunlap. And Dunlap, you know, got to push, batted down one as well, you know, in the game there. But you know, as a whole, I thought the Steelers' offensive line played well.
Yeah, I'm
with especially on blocking to that left side.
Yeah, Villanueva on that 25-yard run by Tom, and they cleaned out a couple holes there. You know, tons of credit to those guys. All right, so
stop. You know, fans need to stop using the narrative that they can't win with Villanueva. and Cody Wallace. Stop it. Those guys aren't going to Pro Bowl. We know it. But they can win with those guys out there. There's a lot of worse.
More importantly, they have won with those guys.
Yeah, yeah, and there's a lot worse situations around the league. Look, it's the planet theory with Villanueva, right? I mean, athletic guys that size.
There aren't any of them walking around. They are. Exactly. They're playing in the NBA.
That's right. So you gave this kid some time to put some weight on. You know his background and his dedication and all like that. He's really had a season and a half, 2 seasons with Mike Munchak. There's still some room for some improvement here. So don't hand me that narrative that the Steelers have to go out there and replace Alejandro Villanueva, because they don't. He plays good enough to win, and they have won.
Okay, let's get to the defense. First half, probably as good as they've played all year. Rivals with what they did in the second half against Denver. They came out in this game. I mentioned this in the pregame show. When I asked Mike Tomlin in the Tuesday presser about tackling, he gave a much longer, more expansive answer than I expected. We saw it in that first half. The Steelers did everything well. They had 5 3 and outs or turnover situations on the Bengals in the first half. They shut down the run game. They got after the passer. They tackled well. They were flying around. That's as good as it gets, Dave. I mean, we can get into specifics. Bud Dupree made some plays. Antoine Blake got the duck interception, but hey, he made it and he returned it well. I don't know that there was a thing to criticize about the defense in the first half.
Boy, how many 3 and outs right off the bat?
Well, the first and the third and the fourth. The second drive was the one where Robert Golden made that pass breakup on third down. Remember, we both tweeted about that on 3rd and 3. And this is the play. These are the plays that get overlooked because they're early in games. But how many times have Dave and I, and I know Steeler fans, just agonized over 3rd and shorts? The Steelers give big cushions and, the guys go to the sticks. They turn around, the ball gets completed, and it's a first down. So many times that we can't even count. And Robert Golden right there on Eifert. Comes around, knocks the ball down on a 3rd and 3 from the Steelers' 38, by the way. First down puts him in field goal range. And then, Marvin Lewis, not showing much cojones, decides to punt right there. So a big play in the game. But, yeah, I know they went 3 and out after that. And I think maybe a couple more times right after that.
Their longest drive in the first half was 8 plays.
And that was that second drive right there.
Second possession. The rest were 3-3-3-3-3, and of course a kneel down at the end of the first half. I didn't think this defense had it in them to play. And look, did the rain affect AJ McCarron? Sure, it did. But so did I think the blitzing as well too. And I think Alex Kozora had some after the initial game charting. Keith Butler blitzed 34% of the time Saturday night. 50 opportunities, up about 10% from the previous 2 games against the Bengals.
Yeah, and dead in between what they did against Baltimore and Cleveland, right? Just almost, right in the middle.
Yeah, and that needed to be done. We talked about that earlier, kind of sugar those gaps. Show him something, make him make some decisions, make him get the football out of there. I thought there were some times at that front that when they sent 4, they did get some pressure, so that was good to see. Jarvis Jones, play of his career, right?
Well, biggest play of his career. I think there was a little too much. I'm not willing to say he had a great game. Ryan Shazier had an unbelievable game. Jarvis Jones made a huge play. Let's say that. And he didn't play badly. I'm not knocking him. I'm just saying, the guy who was the dominant player in the field was Ryan Shazier.
Absolutely. Craig.
Jarvis and Bud Dupree made plays in this game. We hadn't seen much of that.
Right. And we have dogged both those guys. So you got to tip your hat.
Absolutely.
Because I thought Jarvis played out fine outside of that. And he played a lot in this game, too. I thought. Look, the front 7 as a whole played well.
Cam had a strip sack. He doesn't get talked about because the Steelers didn't recover it, but he had one.
That guy is a man child right there. Stephon Tuitt, played very well in that front 7. I think that helped really be a difference maker in this game. And just stop it with the Steelers need to drop Lawrence Timmons. As we talked about in that last, that man can still get from point 8 point A to point B in a hurry. So, you know, one thing, and Bud Dupree, let's not leave Bud Dupree out of
there. I threw him in there.
Okay. The backside, a good crashing down on the backside on one of those. I thought had some nice bend around the edge on a couple of those. One thing that sticks out on that tape, David, from watching it four times already, is Bud Dupree really seems to be communicating more pre-snap with the rest of the defense. That's a good sign that he knows what's going on.
I'm all for it. I'm all for it. Shazier, 13 tackles, 9 solos, 2 for loss, 2 passes defended, 1 QB hit, 1 forced fumble, 1 fumble recovery, and a partridge in a pear tree, as you like to say. Would have recovered the second fumble if Mike Mitchell didn't knock it out of his hands. Better performance than against San Francisco, certainly a bigger stage.
I think about even, right?
Yeah, that's kind of how I'd characterize it as well.
No qualms with that, especially when we were kind of – look, Vince Williams only played 2 snaps in that game, right? Sean Spence didn't play a single defensive snap. So good enough, absolutely good enough as far as Shazier, a guy that we've been on quite a bit this year, just like Jarvis Jones.
Now, let's get to the bad side of this. The Steelers' defense made the play at the end of the game that won the Steelers the game. And they got the play they needed. And they got 4 turnovers, and we know that's what they have to do. And really – if you just put the game up without watching how the game went sequentially, you'd say that's exactly what you're looking for from the defense. 16 points, that's fantastic. 4 turnovers. They absolutely win that game. That's perfect. That's just what you're looking for from the defense. Stuff the run game, basically, and you know, didn't let the big guys or anybody individually, beat you. Great. Except the problem was the way it happened. In 3 drives in the fourth quarter, the Bengals went touchdown, field goal, touchdown. They couldn't get a stop when they needed it most.
No, they couldn't. And boy, how huge was that Shazier ripped out fumble of Jared Hill?
Well, we'd be having a very different tenor to this podcast. Can you imagine? None of that stuff would have happened. And perfect, the conversation would be his interception won the game for him. He was maybe one of the best players on
the
field.
He's a hero. He's a hero.
He's a hero, exactly.
Yeah, I thought the game was over right after the Landry Jones interception, and I think I tweeted out as much, which is rare for me. I usually don't wave the white flag that early on Twitter, but it really looked hopeless after that perfect interception.
I mean,
right,
let's think about it, Dave. Seriously, if the shoe were on the other foot, and we were having this podcast and lost the way the game went down. You'd be killing the running back, whoever it was that fumbled, because just going to the line with 2 hands on the ball, you're not worried about yards. You're in field goal range. You're going to make it so they have to get a touchdown. You're just trying to run clock, and all you have to do is not fumble. So, A, you're killing the running back, and B, you are killing the coach if, on the drive, you got, Mike Mitchell and somebody else got unsportsmanlike conduct penalties, right? I mean, it would be, the city would be burning.
And Burfict's the hero if it stands the way it is. All this stuff that's come out post-game, and I'm sure we're probably still talking about him being thug-like, but he's a hero for some of the things that he does in that game. Look, I thought Hill has had problems fumbling. I was shocked. I thought it would have happened earlier.
The most important thing you got right, or at least, you mentioned, you said at the very end of the last podcast, and I bet Jeremy Hill puts it on the ground once. Well, thank goodness that one came true.
And then the late second Boswell field goal as well, too. I've been trying to call that one all year. The blind squirrel found the nut on that one. But a great, absolutely great job by Ryan Shazier to rip that thing out. And you know what? Even after that happened, I wasn't convinced the Steelers could drive the field. Little did I know they were going to get 30 yards in penalties as a parting gift on top of it. But, hey, that's why you have to play these things out.
Okay, so let's talk. We talked about the front 7 a fair bit. Let's talk about the secondary. We didn't see a lot of Ross Cockrell. And, Dave, I haven't looked – I meant to look at this, and I haven't looked at it again. Maybe you know off the top of your head, but I'm guessing you don't. Here's the surprising thing is Cockrell only played 10 snaps. Blake's the better tackler in the minds of the coaches. Why was Cockrell on the field at the end of the game to recover that fumble? Was Blake also on the field, or was Blake not on the field?
That's a good question.
Yeah, I'll have to look and see if they were both on the field, because I was shocked, Blake being the better tackle, you'd assume he's out.
Wrong.
Yeah, so I'm just curious as to to what was going on there. So, I mean, you know, maybe I'll ask Mike tomorrow. But the secondary in general, two things. One is you pointed it out once that Will Gay got caught looking in the backfield. Let's talk about the two plays that were big for the Bengals. What do you think was the pass interference on Will Allen deserved? I thought it was close. I really do. I know most people said, yeah, it was pass interference. I didn't think it was clearly, you know, no doubt pass interference.
Yeah, I thought it was a questionable call, especially I thought it was questionable in the story. I mean, I think that could go either way.
Okay. And then on the touchdown to A.J. Green, I'm assuming Gay thought he had help over the top. And do you think Mike Mitchell got fooled by A.J. McCarron? Because there was nobody, you know, whatever his responsibilities were, there was nobody in the middle of the field. The only guy remotely close to his area was A.J. Green. Did he screw up?
It's possible. We haven't had a chance to go look at that at the All 22 yet. So I always like to kind of reserve judgment on that. But they got, I think it was a single high on that, wasn't it? With Mitchell?
I don't. I think there was somebody on the other side. I'll have to look at it again too. But I
no, because Gay closes.
Yeah, Gay was not. Gay basically passed him.
I'm watching it right now. Pre-snap. They played man across and they played a single high safety. So.
So then maybe that's on Gay.
I think it's on Gay all the way.
Yeah. Okay. Well, that's fair enough because I wrote and said, you know, Will Gay's
because,
a guy
look,
who likes to take chances. He'll jump routes and he'll sit on routes and he'll do things. He'll anticipate things and he makes big plays. But, you know, that's a tough situation to be doing that.
Well, I mean, look, Gay does sit down.
Yes, he does. And we don't have a ton of time. Give a quick explanation to our listeners what that means.
Well, I mean, it's almost like he's playing zone up underneath.
Right. He's going to stop and couch and, you know, he's basically going to step up and, yeah, exactly. Try and anticipate where things are going.
He forced his man to the inside and then, you know, it's kind of looking like he's playing outside thirds, you know?
Yeah.
So, was he probably maybe expecting somebody to drop back and help over the top because Mitchell's on the other side of the hash mark on the other side of the field. So it'd be interesting. Mike's never going to tell you what happened there. Maybe somebody missed an assignment there.
Yeah.
Maybe Gay was supposed to play, you know, kind of a cover two, kind of a deep half on his end. But the way he kind of comes forward on that play, it looks and sits up underneath. It looks like he was expecting help on over top. Let me see how far Mitchell goes here and who that is. I mean, Mitchell's the one. We'll have to wait today. I hate to make judgments on this without the All 22, Dave. But unless another safety's out of frame there, and how lucky are the Steelers really that Mike Mitchell missed a tackle?
In which case?
I mean, think about it. I mean, that's less than 2 minutes left when he completes the ball to A.J. Green. What if he tackles?
Oh no! Exactly. I was saying, you know, you might want to let the Bengals score there so you have an opportunity.
Right. I mean, so really, you know, once the completion happens, you're almost grateful that Mike Mitchell didn't tackle him at the one because they would have been able to run some time. And then, yeah, you know, obviously anything can happen inside the red zone, you know, fumble. Maybe that's when a Jeremy Hill fumble takes place. But I was kind of glad at that point because at least it gave the Steelers full, you know, couple minutes there.
Okay, we're just about up against it here. Landry Jones, is there anything to say? Coming off the bench cold, didn't do well. But
yeah, I think he got – I mean, look – a hit and miss with that guy, I think obviously not getting work during the practice hurt him. What were we really expecting, though?
Yeah, exactly. I'm with you on all that. Okay, so did the defense win the game for the Steelers, or did the defense put the Steelers in a position that they could have lost, or both?
The Steelers' defense gave them an opportunity to win, and the Bengals' defense provided that win.
Yep, and the Steelers' offense has to do better in the red zone. That's simply enough. They've got to do a better job. Four chances, one TD, but they did enough at the end to get it done.
You know, we talk about sometimes during the playoffs with these good teams, sometimes you're going to need your defense at times to hold the line for you and help you with a win. The Steelers have now used that up, in my opinion, because Keith Butler talks about all the time about the magic number being 17, you know? So The defense did their part. The offense just absolutely has to start playing better, and that's not going to be easy on the road in Denver against a good team that they kind of put it on the last time there. Can they do it two times in a row with an injury?
With you know, your running back, your wide receiver, and your quarterback banged up.
Yeah, with the injured components on offense, we'll see.
All right, man, great stuff. We'll come back at it Wednesday. Hopefully we'll have Troy Rank with us. We'll talk Broncos with him, and we've got a lot more of this to go. And, well, as always, we'll look forward to your feedback.
Follow me on Twitter, at Steelers Depot. Follow David, at David M. Todd. Follow the show, at Terrible Podcast. Email the show, theterriblepodcast@gmail.com. Justin Kirkwood, Barrett Franklin, Joseph Zellner, Chris Milanovich, thank you. Danielle Volk, thank you for the donations. Folks, you can do so. Go to SteelersDepot.com. You'll see the PayPal, the donate button up there at the top. David, get us out of here. I'll talk to you on Wednesday.
As always, thanks for listening to the Terrible Podcast with Dave and Dave.